And Barack Obama is considered the first geek president. Yes, the first geek president. Anthony Laser is the deputy managing editor of the online men's magazine called Asylum. And he's come up with a list of 50 wonderfully geeky moments of 2008. He's here with me right now. And Barack Obama is on your list, I suppose.
Absolutely. He's the biggest story of the year.
Okay. Well, how do you define geek?
I think it's someone who has maybe an intellectual bend and is a little obsessive about pop culture stuff, from comic books to movies. Those sorts of things are very exciting and can be something that we geeks obsess about.
Well, when you think of Barack Obama, you think, well, not necessarily obsessed with pop culture, but really into the internet and mm-hmm. using that, social networking.
Never without his BlackBerry.
Never without it.
Mm-hmm.
Likes comic books.
Loves comic books. Grew up on Spider-Man and Conan the Barbarian.
So
actually.
There you go. So those would be two geek claims to fame.
Exactly. He also, when he met Leonard Nimoy, he flashed him the Vulcan hand symbol.
I happen to know what that is.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, that's it. Right?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, you got that right away.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. So the difference between geek
and dork
and nerd.
And nerd. I would say what a geek is, it's someone who does obsess over comic books, those pop culture things that we were talking about. But at the same time, they can be married. They can attract a
they
woman.
They can have a social
yes.
life.
Yeah. Now, once you start getting into the dork and nerd categories, you have a little bit more difficulty attracting a mate.
All right. Let's get to your list. The 50 wonderfully geeky moments of 2008. Maybe you could share some highlights.
So, you know, we had things like a study at University of California, Davis this year that found out that intelligence increases the likelihood of one-night stands. For men, if a female believes that you're intelligent, that increases the chance of a one-night stand as opposed to if she were to just find you physically attractive. You know, that we also have things like Tina Fey is definitely the geek crush of the year. And I think it's more than the glasses, too.
It's the intelligence.
It's the intelligence, yeah.
Let's get to the top. Let's cut to the chase. The number one geek moment of 2008.
Okay. That was, I know Barack Obama was a big story, but that was number two. Number one was The Dark Knight.
The movie,
yeah.
With Heath Ledger.
It was the biggest movie of the decade so far, if you want to just look at receipts. And, you know, it just seemed like when a comic book hero is the star of the biggest movie of the decade, that seems like a geek story.
And what's your personal favorite geekiest moment of 2008?
My personal favorite on the list? Oh, man.
Geek moments of 2008.
I think the Large Hadron Collider is my favorite one.
Okay, what?
Okay. These European scientists decided they were going to create this amazingly powerful particle smasher to do research. And there were all these conspiracy theorists online that were saying this particle smasher was going to create a black hole.
Uh-huh. Okay, I remember this.
Yes, that would
so was
the eat
interest,
the entire planet.
So it sounds like something out of a sci-fi novel.
Yeah, but it was real. That's what was awesome about it.
So was the interest in the collider itself or the crazy conspiracy theories surrounding it?
Well, the conspiracy theory.
Of course.
Yeah,
of,
I mean, you know, research, scientific research is cool and all. But, I mean, the fact that this might be the doomsday invention that these crazy scientists off somewhere are creating, that we don't know exactly what's going on. And all of a sudden, it could be a black hole that's eating us up. You know what I mean?
Which didn't happen.
No.
By the way.
No. Well, that's the good thing. That's the good part of that story.
Anthony Laser, he's deputy managing editor of the online men's magazine Asylum, where you can read the list of 50 wonderfully geeky moments of 2008. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Malin.
Okay, you might not remember exactly what you were doing on, say, a Friday in April at 7:15 p.m. this past year. Well, the photographers at sametime715.com do remember, because they've been documenting each day with photos at 7:15 p.m. for the past year, day after day after day. It all started when a professor and his former student decided to work on a photography project. And this evolved into hundreds of photos coming from six different lives. NPR's Leah Scarpelli tagged along.
What if one of us photographed the front of the house and one of us photographed the back of the house?
Michael Leese is visiting friends. It's about 7:10 p.m., stir fries on the stove. Leese is mulling over what he'll photograph tonight with former student and co-founder of the project, Brad Walker.
So just what if we photograph the two of them since we're in their house and they're making us dinner and you're holding their cat?
Over this past year, they and four other photographers have each taken a photo every day at the same time and then uploaded the images to their public website. Here's Brad Walker.
It was kind of like to have a place we could just see a ton of photos. That's what we talked about.
Scroll across the pictures, and you might see bright green vegetables cooking in a pan, a pair of feet viewed from above, a game of pool or Scrabble in action. All ordinary things, maybe, but for the photographers of Same Time 715, that's the whole point, or at least how contributor Kate McDonald describes it.
It's just some little private thing in your life, the thing that's happening inside of your little small apartment, not like on any larger scale at all.
And she says taking a photo at 7:15 p.m. reveals a lot about who's behind the lens.
You aren't at your work, and you haven't really sunken into your nighttime activity, so it's kind of this limbo-y time, but it's your real life.
So you take the photo. Next step? Add a caption. Michael Leese.
I generally want it to always be really explicit about what I was doing at that time, because I see it very much as a diary that I'm maybe one day going to look back at and that it's going to matter.
Some photos are poignant. Others are just baffling. Some hold memories or tell stories of childhood. One shows a hand holding a bright orange crooked carrot. When my Nana was alive, the caption reads, "We slice the carrots we put in salads. We peel them now." Song Wiser, another collaborator, believes the project is different from, say, Facebook or even an ordinary photo album.
The larger memories over your past year will tend to stand out, but then the smaller ones definitely fall through the cracks, and Same Time does a lot to just remind you of those little pleasures, too.
The website could also resonate with people outside the group, says Michael Leese.
What I hope happens if you stumble upon it is kind of grandiose, but in a way, I hope that it's sort of an act of humility to take the time to look and to read, and that you are allowing six other people's lives into your own life. By my time, it's 7:30.
So far, there's no image for tonight. We're back in the kitchen, and Michael and Brad are still debating what to photograph.
Wait, maybe you should just photograph Leah standing there, and I'll photograph Adam here, and then we'll all be in the photograph.
Since I was standing there at 7:15, I ended up on the website.
We're all doing like this ridiculous amount of stuff.
2, 1.
Leah Scarpelli, NPR News.
Okay, you can see some photos at npr.org, and the photographers of Same Time 715 take their final pictures today.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. And it's time now for our weekly technology segment, All Tech Considered. Last week, we looked at how technology is changing the way charity organizations help those in need. This week, we look at how technology is changing how we let loose, specifically the evolution of video gaming. And think about this. When the game Grand Theft Auto 4 was released earlier this year, it made a whopping $500 million in its debut week. And that is $300 million more than the opening of the movie hit Iron Man that opened the same week. And while movies typically cost $100 million or more to produce, games cost no more than half that. Well, to help us understand what's been happening in that video game world, I'm joined, as always, by our tech expert, Omar Gayaga. Welcome back, Omar.
Hi, good to talk to you, Robert.
Video gaming, obviously a massive profitable industry, and we're not just talking about kids nagging with their parents to buy them games at the mall. We're talking about a very committed base of consumers, and in fact, an industry that's being held as recession-proof. Tell us a bit about that.
Right. Well, it's a very big industry, close to $10 billion last year and growing this year. people like me who grew up with video games are now in their 30s and 40s, and we kind of represent this hardcore gamer demographic that's gotten older and more affluent. Just in November alone, game sales were $2.64 billion. And the Nintendo Wii is still, 2 years after it launched, a huge runaway success. About more than 2 million Nintendo Wii systems were sold in just in November. We don't have the numbers yet for December holidays, but everyone is expecting they're going to be huge blockbuster numbers. So yeah, big, big numbers. And it seems like this holiday season, definitely recession-proof.
For games. Now, with the Nintendo Wii, with that console, the graphics aren't as much the story as the fact that your controller allows you to control the motion of your character. This is the most physically interactive of all of these games.
Right, and the Wii really proved this other trend in video games, which is kind of reaching out to the mainstream. Nintendo didn't try to cater just to hardcore gamers that have been playing games all their lives. They really extended the market to moms, to people who hadn't picked up a game controller in 10 years, people who wanted to play virtual bowling in Wii Sports or get in shape with Wii Fit. They really sort of brought the fun back into video games and created games that are easy to pick up and play.
Some other new trends in games?
Well, there is a really big movement in so-called casual games. These are games you might download to your phone or might play in your office over Facebook, stuff like Bejeweled or Mahjong or the Facebook version of Scrabble. Casual gamers have also, just like the Wii, brought in a lot of casual gamers into the fold, people who wouldn't consider themselves gamers but who, you know, might spend some time playing for, you know, 15, 20 minutes at a time. Then there's the virtual music games, the Guitar Hero games and Rock Band. Those really exploded last holiday season and have also done well this holiday season. They're games where you create a virtual band and you have vocals, virtual drums and guitars. You get together with your friends and you play popular music. You might be playing Nirvana or Metallica. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're playing along to popular music. And it's sort of the video game version of playing karaoke.
And Omar, as Bilal was told there, and as I gather, this is no longer about shut-ins alone in the room. It's a social activity, playing a game like that.
Right. The current wave of games, especially on the Nintendo Wii, kind of signal this shift to this living room renaissance of social gaming. Gamers have always gotten together to play in groups, you know, fighting games, football games. But these are games that are easier to pick up and play and more fun to play in a group. And even if you don't have a group of friends to play with, you can play most of these games online. A few months ago, I played Rock Band with my college roommate, who I hadn't seen in 10 years. I played drums, and he did vocals on Tangled Up in Blue, even though we were in different states. We chatted over our Xbox headsets, and it was like we were in the same room.
So where can we expect this social gaming trend to go next?
Well, a lot of it is online. Virtual worlds are continuing to expand. But really, everyone's looking at Nintendo and seeing, you know, where can we go from there with motion controllers, with controlling games with gestures. They were going to see a move away from standard controllers and keyboards and mice and more toward a more virtual, you know, stand-up-and-play experience. Also, 3D, I think, is going to be a big trend in gaming. We're starting to see that in theaters. That technology is going to come home, and we're going to start seeing more games in 3D that you'll be able to play on your HDTV.
Well, Omar, thanks as always for bringing us up to speed.
Thanks for having me, Robert.
That is Omar Gayaga, who covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman.
2008 has been a productive year for technology companies. They've kept churning out gadgets or new advances of the devices we now carry in our pockets, purses, or clip on our ears. We ask Morning Edition tech guru Mario Armstrong to select one innovation as the technology pick of the year, and he's here to tell us what that is. Welcome, Mario.
Hey, Renee. Thanks for having me. I can't believe you're tying me down to one pick.
That's how it goes with these sort of end-of-the-year things, but let's have it. What's your pick?
All right. So my pick, it's text messaging by the campaigns throughout the election. I believe the use of technology on our mobile devices overshadowed any other technology that came out this year.
Okay, so, well, that's an actual use of technology, not, say, a new gadget. But many of us will remember one thing that loomed quite large, and that was the use of a text message by the Obama campaign to announce Barack Obama's vice presidential pick. And it was a, sort of like people were waiting for it the way they were waiting for the iPhone.
Absolutely. This was the first time in history that this had been done. And it came out at 3 o'clock in the morning and people still, Eastern time, and people still were lining up to wait to see who this pick was going to be on their mobile device.
What else did the campaigns do to make innovative use of technology?
So they also took it a step further beyond just doing things like text messaging. I mean, some campaigns even created iPhone applications. These were programs that would actually run on your iPhone that would give you news, information, updates, even track your calls if you were making calls and being very active. But then there was this just a mix, all of the pieces together, utilizing the internet, utilizing email, text messaging, online video, things like YouTube and others. I think the one thing for me, Renee, as to why this really stood out is when I started meeting people that were older generation that really weren't into technology, but because of the election, they found themselves gravitating and really utilizing and embracing technology in new ways, ways that they have never done before. And that has continued them now to have better connections with family, friends, and relatives.
Well, let's talk about, I think, what we could call iPhone moments, because last year the iPhone swept headlines. You even chose it as your pick of 2007. Any parallel iPhone moments this year?
There are a couple of parallel iPhone moments, and there are three devices that really come out that gravitate towards me. One is called the Peak. This is kind of like your iPhone. All it does, Renee, is email. It's a little device that you carry with you. No phones, no camera, no web browsing. All it does is it has a keyboard and a screen, and it allows you to send and receive email. It's very simple, and it's great for the non-techie. Another quick one would be the Pulse Pen, a pen that actually records what's being heard as you're writing, and then allows you to save that and kind of go back to your notes later and listen to any of your notes that you've taken. It's an awesome device. And then I guess my last pick would be Zoom. This is a wireless service that has now come out. It's called WiMAX service, and it's now available in the U.S. And essentially what makes this different is it is about 3 to 4 times faster than current wireless internet speeds. So think of this as a hotspot as wide as your city, not a hotspot that just surrounds a coffee shop at really fast blazing speeds. So, Renee, those would be three other things that really caught my attention for 2008, but by far, the number one would be use of text messaging in the election.
All right, then, 2008 in technology from Mario Armstrong, Morning Edition's regular technology commentator. Thank you.
Thank you, Renee.
And, of course, Mario also hosts the radio show Digital Cafe on Baltimore Public Radio station WYPR.
One of the most popular comic strips popping up online is called Penny Arcade. It's transformed its creators into underdog heroes. David Kushner, our digital culture commentator, is here to tell us more. Hi, David.
Hi.
Tell us about Penny Arcade. What is it?
Well, Penny Arcade has become like Doonesbury for geeks. It's free, and you can find it at penny-arcade.com. It was started by a couple guys in Seattle named Mike and Jerry, and it basically satirizes digital culture and industry.
Tell us more about what the strips are about. I mean, Doonesbury for geeks, that could go in any direction.
Well, it follows the lives of these two floppy-haired young friends named Tycho and Gabe, and they basically like to talk about nerdy stuff like Dungeons & Dragons and Nintendo and kind of dealing with the frustrations of tech support. In one strip, there was a heated debate about whether the old Rick Springfield song Jesse's Girl should be included in the game Guitar Hero. You know, other times they'll take on political issues that kind of fit this world. There was a strip about video game violence that featured Pac-Man himself on trial.
So how did the creators of this online comic strip, Penny Arcade, turn it into a cottage industry?
Well, because they really were born online and they have this gigantic fan base, they were able to really cultivate it in a way that they maybe couldn't if they didn't have that direct line of communication. So now they host a convention every year called the Penny Arcade Expo in Seattle, which actually draws about 30,000 fans at a time. They've got a merchandise line. They've got a multi-million-dollar charity called Child's Play, where they're providing video games for kids in hospitals. They even have their own online video games. And the latest is called Penny Arcade Adventures on the Rain-Slick Precipice of Darkness, Episode 2.
There are some obvious differences between online comics and printed ones. But how would you say that online comics are different from the printed ones?
I think in a couple of ways. I mean, one is that they have more freedom to experiment. For example, Penny Arcade has running jokes about their lack of continuity. So people can die one day in the strip and then they can come back the next day. On another level, they also get to represent a culture which you just might not read about in your Sunday paper. And in this case, it's really not the family circus that you're reading. It's the world of these underdogs of the digital age.
No superheroes.
No superheroes unless they happen to be in the comic books that the characters in the strip are reading at the time.
David Kushner writes for Rolling Stone and Wired. His latest book, Levittown, will be published in February. David, thank you.
Thank you.